One of the things that is constant in the American psyche is a level of unease with the federal government. Fierce defenders of the country and its institutions will still occasionally question those institutions and their intentions. Our guest this hour definitely questions the aims of our federal government. It makes the case that all our country learned in putting down counterinsurgencies in other countries is being used against us here at home. Bernard E. Harcourt's book is called The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Bernard Harcourt is a professor of law and political science at Columbia University in New York. His work as a human rights lawyer included defending death row inmates, and his previous books covered the justice system, the economic system, and society's love for exposure online and what it costs us. Bernard Harcourt, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
So the opening pages we read of torture of suspected terrorists, drone strikes, domestic surveillance programs, and militarized local police forces. You see them all of a piece, I see.
Yeah, that's it. There's something that unifies all of those things. And you know, a lot of time we just think those are just aberrations and they're, you know, isolated events, you know, that the torture that we did in the waterboarding, that was just an isolated event. But the more I started to think about it, the more I realized that they actually fit together. They fit together in this way of governing. They all are pieces of a counterinsurgency warfare strategy, basically.
And I want to point out up front, this is not just a screed. I mean, you cite copious sources and page after page of notes, including the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, from the opening page.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, the more you look at them in detail, right, the more all of a sudden they start making sense. They start making sense that they work together towards a broader new approach to kind of governing the American people and governing abroad. I mean, it started abroad with the use of torture, the use of, well, those were counterinsurgency strategies and tactics that had been developed in the 1960s by the French in Algeria, by the British in Malaya, and you know the United States also used some of these strategies in Vietnam. But when you see that the same kind of strategies were being used after 9/11, all of a sudden these different events, these different problems start to make sense. So torture, for instance, we often kind of chalk it to some aberration, but torture was always an integral part of a counterinsurgency warfare strategy in the 1960s. It was used to terrorize populations. It was used to obtain information, but it was an integral piece of the counterinsurgency strategy, which basically has three prongs to it. You know, one of them is to get all of the information you can about a population. The second one is to then identify and eliminate a small minority that's the insurgency. And then the third prong is to pacify the masses, or what we used to call win the hearts and minds. And these different strategies, these different pieces of the picture, all of a sudden fit very neatly in that three-prong strategy with the kind of total information awareness through NSA eavesdropping and all of the NSA programs, through forms of torture or drone strikes as a way to eliminate a small minority, and then also these different ways of distracting the population today.
So does the government then, I guess the question really revolves around consciousness. I mean, does the government have this counter-revolution you see because it sees a revolution in progress or an attempted one?
Well, that's what's so puzzling, is that there really isn't a revolution in progress, at least in the United States, right? There really isn't an insurgency. And so what we have right now kind of is a perfected model of governing through counterinsurgency in a context where there isn't an insurgency. So in order to make it work, you have to create a fictitious insurgent. You have to start talking about, say, you know, Muslims as being insurgent. You have to start talking about a Muslim ban to try and keep out insurgents. Or what the FBI has started to do is to develop this category of the black identity extremist, right, as an insurgent. Basically, what happens is in the present context is that because there isn't really an insurgency going on now, in order for this way of governing to work, you have to create one. You have to create the illusion of one to then get all the mechanisms going.
So this suggests overall that whatever we do militarily ends up coming home and being incorporated into the national fiber in some way or another.
Yeah, it comes home to roost. You know, the big difference here, and it's precisely, you're entirely right, the big difference is that in the 1940s, 50s, 1930s as well, right, there was a very different warfare paradigm, which was the large battlefield warfare from World War One, from the, you know, from Verdun and the Blitzkrieg, these imaginations of and realities of huge armies and large battlefields, and that came home as well. I mean, that shaped the way we thought about political interventions, about governing during those periods. It's not a surprise that we had, you know, the war on poverty, right, or the war on crime, or these huge governmental interventions that were getting at the wide scope of things, okay? And we've changed. The war model has changed, and it's come home to roost so that we have these much more strategic and counterinsurgency practices that we develop targeting particular groups like Muslims or African-American protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters.
Right, so much more smaller scale for sure. We have much more to talk about with Bernard Harcourt as we unpack his book, The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. A rather provocative viewpoint, which you can join us to talk about on The Exchange by phone or email. We'll be back on The Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Bernard E. Harcourt, professor of law and political science at Columbia University in New York. His works tend to be somewhat provocative. The latest is no different. It's called The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. He makes the case that all the things the United States learned in counterinsurgency overseas, it brought home and uses against the people now. You may be scared by it, you may be dismissive of it, but it is certainly well researched. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So to refine the point we were just talking about, so where we used to think in big terms, I mean, World War II was a very big war with very large battlefields and lots of people and machinery involved. But over time, we've tended to think more, well, we're sort of fighting guerrilla insurgencies in a similar vein, aren't we?
Right, exactly. And along with those different ways of fighting war come different ways of governing in terms of foreign affairs, but then also, I mean, it comes home to roost of governing at home. And so in those times of large battlefield warfare, we had policies that were of equal scope, right? When you think about it, the New Deal was one of these, you know, large battlefield policies across the whole country with the Tennessee Valley Authority, et cetera. But also, after World War II, with the war on poverty, these were large-scale battlefield war ideas brought home to deal with problems at home, right? And what's happened is that since 9/11, the counterinsurgency war paradigm has really taken over militarily in terms of our engagements in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the Middle East. And people have been trained in that way of thinking General Petraeus issued a really important counterinsurgency manual that was distributed to everyone in the military in 2006 that spelled out the different prongs of a counterinsurgency approach, what you have to do in terms of gathering information and then identifying particular insurgents and then kind of targeting them and eliminating them, and also working on the general population and swaying them, giving them some necessary basic services so that they feel better about us as an invading force. Now, all of those lessons, all of those strategies, all those tactics were then become part of our fiber in some sense. I mean, because, you know, so many of our men and women go into the military and are in Iraq and Afghanistan and absorb this, and they and all of their peers and families start to absorb the counterinsurgency logics, such that pretty soon we're here in this country and dealing with issues, dealing with problems, and all of a sudden we're kind of deploying the same strategies. And I think you've seen it more and more on domestic ground. So, for instance, the hyper-militarized police responses to nonviolent protest against police excess in Ferguson and Baltimore and elsewhere. I mean, these images of a police force domestically that you'd think you're in some moat in Afghanistan, the way these officers are equipped. And, of course, it's all excess equipment that comes from the war in Iraq. But we're talking about military-grade assault weapons, scopes, night scopes, grenade launchers, armored vehicles, MRAs that are from Iraq, and you've got a police force that all of a sudden is facing off against, you know, peaceful protesters in T-shirts, but you'd think you're in some moat or village in Afghanistan. You see it also with the, for instance, police surveillance. So the NYPD here in New York, after 9/11, started this infiltrating mosques without any legitimate suspicion. There wasn't any reasonable suspicion about these particular mosques, but started to infiltrate the mosques and send in people who would provide information. Infiltrated student groups, like a white water rafting group from the, you know, CUNY student group. They'd sent an undercover police officer to go whitewater rafting with these folks.
And CUNY is Pace University, is that right?
It was, you know, I think it was Brooklyn College.
Okay.
And basically they had an undercover cop go along with these 12 students on their, you know, whitewater rafting trip to find out, you know, what they were thinking about. You know, many of the students were Muslim, and so they were using it as a way to figure out what Muslim students were thinking. But all of these tactics that were, you know, developed in terms of this kind of surveillance and infiltration in a counterinsurgency model are being deployed. Or, for instance, the use of total information awareness on Americans through all of the NSA programs, the prison programs, et cetera. That's you know, basic step one to a counterinsurgency approach, is to try and get information from all of the population, and not just from the targeted insurgents, but from all of the population, so that you can distinguish, you know, the good from the bad.
As they figure out who's who.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of like basic step one to counterinsurgency. Or even more recently, we've seen, for instance, with the use of a robot bomb in Dallas, Texas, about a year and a half.
It was when the five police officers were shot.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Now, that was a very interesting event because it was a drone, right? A robot bomb. Now, you know, you don't really use drone bombs in the context of civilian policing, right? Now, in warfare, it's ordinary.
Which, and you draw the line between, for example, the killing of an American civilian, several, Anwar al-Awlaki was the most recognizable one overseas, but then you draw the parallel between that and the killing of the police shooter in Dallas.
Yeah, because when you think about it, right, in the civilian context, a police officer sometimes needs to use lethal force to disable a suspect. And that's covered by the law. That's legitimate. I mean, for good cause, you can use even lethal force to disable a suspect if they're dangerous to others, et cetera, whatnot. But this wasn't disabling. This was eliminating. This was kind of sending in a bomb that would kill the suspect. Now, in the civilian context, you don't know if the suspect is actually guilty. The suspect hasn't been tried. The suspect may have mental health disorder. The suspect may be insane, legally insane. You know, you just don't know.
But the point was to kill, not to disable.
Exactly,
are there not precedents, though, Bernard? I mean, when you look at things like John Dillinger getting shot outside the theater in Chicago?
Well, yeah, I mean, lethal force is used in a lot of encounters, and we've seen illegitimate uses of it increasingly with all the videos and whatnot. But in a situation, it's always in a situation what you're trying to do is to disable, not to execute, right? And so there are certain techniques that go with disabling rather than executing. A remote drone bomb is not a form of disabling. It's a form of execution.
Bernard Harcourt, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of law and political science at Columbia University in New York. He's written a book called The Counter-Revolution, subtitled How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. His argument is that the counterinsurgency techniques learned overseas by the American military have become adopted into first our foreign policy and then our domestic policy as well. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, agree or disagree. Let's hear from you. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So a question to ask here at the midpoint is, when you act like there's an insurgency, do you ultimately get one?
You know, I'm not sure that you ultimately get one, but I think what the result is that we start to imagine that it exists. Okay, in other words, we start to interpret events as if they validate the idea that there is a counter, that there is an insurgency. So, I mean, you know, what's been going on in this country? Well, there are a lot of violent acts. In fact, there are an extraordinary number of violent acts every day in this country, with shootings that involve multiple victims and fatalities every single day, and we see that tragically across the country. We saw that very recently, tragically. In Florida, so we have a lot of there are a lot of violent episodes every day. Many of them are unstable individuals who gravitate towards some kind of extreme ideology. Oftentimes, it's towards something like white supremacist ideology. Sometimes it's some radical Islamic fundamentalism. But we mostly see loose cannon or unstable individuals doing that. Now, but when we start to imagine that there is an insurgency, all of a sudden, when we have one of those individuals, we start to think that it confirms the fact that there is an insurgency. So, for instance, in New York, there was an individual who put some pressure cookers in some luggage and left it in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, two pieces, and you know, the Chelsea bomber is what he became known as. But was that just an unstable individual who then gravitated towards extreme ideology, or, and this is what happens, I think, was it someone who all of a sudden starts to confirm our imagination that there actually is an insurgency going on in this country. And it's that, it's the latter, I think. It starts to become a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And I don't think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense necessarily that this is going to fuel or feed an insurgency or create an insurgency. I think what it does is it's mostly in our minds we start to see something that actually isn't there, because it's necessary to the form of governing some way, we start to kind of say, oh well, wait a minute, there we go, there is an insurgency.
Because it convinces people, and there's a bunch of illustrations in the book, I should point out, including a picture of General David Petraeus's graph on support for insurgency, and it shows the minority, the insurgents, the hardcore people,
right.
and it shows the another group, the other end of the spectrum, really couldn't care less one way or the other, and a huge group in the middle, which sort of reminds me of the charts we see of American politics, where you're really just trying to tug a bunch of people who are not terribly interested, but you know have some stake in the matter, to feel like they have a stake.
Right. Yeah, that chart is fascinating because actually, that's the underlying logic of counterinsurgency theory, and it's lifted directly from the French commanders who developed this logic in Algeria, and it is this vision of the world of a society that's divided into these three parts. Right, a small tranche of insurgents. So a small minority of insurgents at one end of society, a small minority of the counterinsurgents of the commanders of the people who are trying to repress the insurgency at the other end of society, and in the middle a big passive massive population that could go either way. And that was, of course, the underlying logic of counterinsurgency theory from the 1960s, and that the idea there, of course, was that you wanted to try and win the hearts and minds of that big mass of passive people in the middle, and the worry was that the insurgents, or you know, the Viet Cong or the FLN in Algeria, would win that mass of the population over to its side, bring it over to its side, and then of course that would be the end. And you know, in Algeria, that's pretty much what happened, since there was ultimately a successful revolution there.
Yeah, it was not a pretty ending.
No.
So let's talk about how this relates to what the United States has been doing, though, and
right.
how this comes home. So, for example, how does an effort to portray or confirm the legitimacy of the state in Afghanistan by American forces convert to something here at home?
Right. So the same logic gets adopted in our counterinsurgency practices abroad. And so Petraeus spells them out brilliantly in this counterinsurgency manual, right? So you got to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan population by providing basic services to them, right? By doling out some cash, by making sure that they have water and some basic medical care, and so there's a whole aspect to the counterinsurgency manual, an important part of the counterinsurgency manual, that's all about providing these goodies to the Afghan population so that they won't be swayed by the insurgents. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question then becomes, how does this logic come home to roost? You know, what is this trying to kind of? What is this about the same logic then here? You have to identify a small insurgency. Well, you have to pretty much in this country you have to make it up because I don't think it exists. So what do you do? Well, you start talking about Muslims in general. You start creating a Muslim ban, for instance. You start identifying black identity extremists as a new category that the FBI needs to watch. So you start creating these shadow insurgents. But then you also have to pacify the masses, the people. And how are we doing that? I think that we're right now, we're The predominantly it's being done through this 24-hour reality TV. One day is an episode of a TV series, News Media Blitz, under the new administration, mm-hmm. that is keeping us so occupied and distracted by all of the daily programming, this kind of reality TV daily programming, that we can't even take a step back and talk about anything else, or understand what's going on. We haven't been in the media. We haven't been talking about drone strikes anymore, for instance, right?
Not much.
They're actually up. The numbers have increased under the Trump administration, but you don't hear a word about drone strikes. Why is it? Because we're so busy with, you know, who's the latest person in the cabinet who's quitting, or who's the latest person in the White House who's lost their job or resigning, or you know, or what's happening to the family members, or what's going on at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, we're so kind of caught up in this daily TV reality show. That we're not even paying attention anymore to the kinds of practices, both abroad and at home, that are deeply troubling.
And that add up to what you see as the counter-revolution. That's the name of the book by Bernard Harcourt, subtitled How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. We'll pick up the conversation on the other side of a break. You can join us by phone or email, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on The Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Bernard Harcourt, a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. He has worked as a human rights lawyer, has defended death row inmates, written books on the justice system, the economic system, and our love for exposure online. His latest book pulls a bunch of things together, and it's called The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens, the argument that the things we learned in counterinsurgency overseas are being used on the American people now. You may be scared by it, you may disagree with it completely, but let's get into a conversation here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about the media aspect of this, and I was mulling that during the break, because even the people who consider themselves very serious people, and some people capitalize that as VSP and covering the news, still get caught up in what is essentially celebrity news about the personalities coming and going from the White House.
Right. Yeah, that seems to dominate. That seems to dominate the news cycle at this point. And I think that it, it's kind of a people approach to politics, mm-hmm. right? But I think that it really works in sucking the American population into these distractions. Because they're essentially distractions, right?
But are they deliberate distractions, I guess, is where we get down. I mean, are they smart at the White House about making sure that we're paying attention to the people and the personalities, or are they just blundering into it?
Well, frankly, I mean, President Trump himself stated, or proudly embraced the idea that for his presidency, he wanted every day to be like another TV show.
Right.
Right? And that's what we've got. And that's what we've got, and we're glued to the screen, right? I mean, you know, who was it who resigned yesterday, right?
Gary Cohen. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the big issue, and then we get all this kind of like people, celebrity, who is he, what's he like, pictures of him. It's just like, you know, what's going to happen next, what's going to happen in terms of who's going to be the next person, you know. I mean, you've got this cycling, you've got this revolving door, right? So it's constantly revolving with people coming in, people going out. You get the coming in stories, you get the going out stories. And it's practically monopolizing our news and attention so that other important stories, other things that are going on, are simply sidelined, sidetracked completely. And any discussion, any serious discussion of foreign policy or domestic policy is, I think, being sidelined by this type of reality TV presidency.
Let's return to the idea that to the General Petraeus graph that you have in the book that shows a small group of counterinsurgents, a small group of counterinsurgents, and then a passive mass in the middle. And the job of either side is to try to convince those people to come with them.
Right.
There's a real echo of that in societies that is reflected in police departments, as you point out in the book. Reddit Hudson, formerly of the St. Louis Police, had a really interesting observation about what he saw in the business. Can you relate that to us?
Yeah, well, you know, this logic, it starts to creep into so many different areas, so many different areas of the way we start to think about things. We start to think about things as like, oh, wait a minute, this is a small number of people who are, you know, doing all of the, police brutality or something like that, right? Or that, you know, you've got to start then identifying the small number of dangerous individuals in society to target them, right? It becomes so these logics that are developed militarily and abroad, and you know, the manual, the counterinsurgency manual, is distributed to all of the military personnel. It starts to get internalized, and then someone who's been kind of indoctrinated in the counterinsurgency might then be running a police department or something, and uses the same way of thinking about society, that out there are these small number of individuals that are dangerous, that they're the ones that you have to target and eliminate in the same way, right? So it's a logic that has this infectious or contagious element to it, and then that starts to affect the way we think about lots of different things, and particularly policing, because the line between military strategy and policing strategy is pretty thin.
Let's take a call here. We have Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bernard Harcourt, the author of The Counter-Revolution.
Eddie.
Hi.
Back in the 60s, early 70s, I fought the war in Vietnam in the streets of Portland and Eugene. And I think the worst that came at us was when we had a whole thick line of police going from one building across the park blocks to another building and just coming down in a phalanx with clubs in front of them, hup two, et cetera. But nobody pulled a gun. And the people were not really that much in fear of their lives. Now people are more like, well, the police, we've learned, are definitely more likely to go for the guns. Usually the people don't have one. Sometimes they do, and that gets bloody.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what brought on this whole change in attitude and approach and behavior where the police are likely to get a lot more fast and loose with the use of deadly force?
All right. Thanks for that question, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great question. That's a great question. And it is interesting, I think, that there has been, as a result, maybe, of the logic of counterinsurgency taking hold, right, and becoming more justified, I think, then the strategies that go with it are more easily adopted and triggered, right? And so, I think that what's happened is that strategies that before might have been more experimental or unsure have taken hold, so that now that they seem more legitimate and more justified, it's easy to simply or just to turn to those strategies and deploy them, right? So I think that there might have been a greater hesitation even in the 60s or 70s to deploy full military kind of counterinsurgency equipment in the civilian context. I think we did see examples of excessive use of force, and you know, Kent State and others. So it's not as if it didn't happen.
Right.
But I think that there was more hesitation. There was more of a notion that, you know, we in the civilian context, we try not to use the military, right? There was, and I think that that has eroded, in part because the logic of counterinsurgency has become so dominant, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's just less hesitation, right? Because this works. We've seen that it works. We think that it works. We believe that it worked. That's a big if, obviously.
Right, but you know, it does sort of, there's the echo of the first Gulf War and the idea that overwhelming force was used by the Americans to get that under control very quickly.
Right, right, right. And then all of a sudden it seems that, well, that's right, let's do that. We'd do it more easily. The trigger is quicker, and then we find ourselves in these situations.
We have a couple of responses here I want to bring to your attention, and two of them, one anonymous, one from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, are along the lines of you're kind of missing the point that this is really the way we work. It's a systemic issue. That's the general nature of those. But then Jenny in Roseburg writes that she's recently gone deep into the world of online right-wing conspiracy theories, and she's concerned that you're falling into a mirror image of the mistake of looking for patterns, and from that inferring conscious manipulation by powers that be. So she asks, who's responsible for manipulating and coordinating this organized, in quotes, organized counterinsurgency that you surmise is happening? That's Jenny in Roseburg.
Right, yeah. Well, so those comments are really helpful, and I mean, they push us in two very different directions. You know, one is that this is entirely systemic, and the other is I'm being too much of a conspiracy theorist. So too systemic. This is what I'd say. I try to avoid all my life being kind of a conspiracy theorist. And this is what I would say. I don't think that it's that there's one mind, a mastermind that's bringing about this use of counterinsurgency warfare as a governing model in this country. And it's not, I don't think it's masterminded by, you know, any one individual who knows exactly what they're doing.
So no puppet masters, no string pullers.
There's not a string puller. But what there is, though, is an ideology, a way of thinking, which is this counterinsurgency, that becomes very convincing and very powerful. And so people start, and people from different areas of the government start to think that actually there's a lot to this way of thinking about the population, for instance, as a bit of a massive, passive population that can be swayed in different directions, that there's a lot to that. And then slowly but surely, this vision, this way of seeing the world, it's kind of like a pair of glasses that people start to wear, and many people are starting to wear this same pair of glasses as a result of, you know, as a result of serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance, or reading about it, or being influenced by, you know, the counterinsurgency manual, and so. A lot of people start to see the world this way, and then that's when we kind of slip into those modes, right? So, for instance, the use of the robot bomb in Dallas, Texas, right? I mean, I don't think it's not masterminded that we're going to slowly start using effectively drone warfare in the civilian context, and you know, we'll start here. It's just that, you know, it started to make sense for that police chief right there, maybe because of his experiences, maybe because he was starting to see the world through this lens of kind of insurgents and whatnot, and then that happens, and so we see it coming from different areas. I don't think that it's a coordinated effort, but I do believe that there is some way of seeing the world that starts to become more current and starts to become a little bit more dominant, and that's what we have.
So which gets us to a point where what you're describing doesn't sound totally dissimilar from what the folks on Fox News, Sean Hannity in particular, describe as the deep state.
Well,
I mean, maybe 180 degrees from that, so, but I mean, you're still seeing a pattern.
The difference here is that I mean, I think that the notion of the deep state is much more coordinated than the idea that I have with a way of seeing the world that becomes somewhat shared and controlling.
So more groupthink than conspiracy.
Exactly. Yes. Yes, that's right.
So, Bernard, if people are not okay with what you perceive here, how do they address it without appearing to be, in fact, the revolution that was suspected all along?
Right, exactly. That's kind of the trick, isn't it? Or that's the paradox here. I mean, well, in part, it's, you know, through because you address it through nonviolent means. I mean, you try and expose this logic. You try and kind of show what's going on. In nonviolent ways and resist some of these practices in nonviolent ways and there are people across society in various different places who can have an effect, right? They're police officers who can kind of resist the kind of hyper-militarization of the police force, or police administrators who could say, wait a minute, you know, maybe we don't need tanks from Iraq on Main Street, right? So in various different places across society, there are ways of saying, wait a minute, maybe we don't need this. You know, maybe the Muslim ban, right? Why create the Muslims as an internal enemy in this country? We can try and stop that somehow.
Right, and also think about how you use social media. That's the subject of the previous book he had, Exposed.
Right.
Bernard Harcourt, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book, The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Bernard, thank you for joining us today.